This podcast is intended for investment professionals. Welcome to Elgium Talks. I'm your host, Mark Chappell. When I think about how I shop now, and here I don't mean what I shop for, but the actual buying process, and compare that, say, to 5 years ago, the difference is enormous. More or less everything I buy is online and delivered to me in a matter of days or even hours. And I can literally count on one hand the types of things where I'd want to physically drive to a shop and inspect it before paying for it and driving it home myself. And it's this sort of changing consumer behavior that has really propelled industrial spaces, especially those related to e-commerce logistics, from a world that's often characterized as steady but dull property investment returns into a real growth story for commercial property investors. For this week's episode, I'm joined by members of our Real Assets team to look at the urban logistics story and why you perhaps shouldn't go guns blazing into this investment opportunity. As always, if you're enjoying Elgium Talk, subscribe to us in your podcast app and maybe even leave us a 5-star rating while you're there. Now, my first guest is Tim Packer, Assistant Fund Manager on the Industrial Property Investment Fund. Hi, Tim. Welcome to Elgium Talks.
Hello there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for joining us. And also returning to the podcast is Bill Page, Head of Real Assets Market Research. Bill, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Mark.
Now, I think you've talked to us about healthy office spaces, predicting successful cities, and now the industrial sector. So what areas don't you cover?
Well, I'm tempted to say jack of all trades, but I won't finish the second half of that phrase. But it's a great time to be a generalist in the sector. Mm. There's loads going on, not only in engineering and finance and traditional surveying skills, but also understanding, you know, what's driving the consumer. So a bit of psychology, a bit of sociology. And as we said with health and wellbeing the other week, the biology and physiology of office space.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so much more that we have to think about as property investors going forward.
Yeah, it's not just the bricks and mortar, and it's not just an empty shell that gets handed over to an occupier. There's a lot to do over the length of the lease to make sure our occupiers get the most out of their estate.
I mean, to take that back to industrial, people often refer to this as sheds. Tim, can you tell us that? I'm assuming there's a lot more to it than just sheds.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very, very diverse sector. Certainly when you're looking to market an empty warehouse, you really don't have a clue who your occupier will be. It could be a music studio, it could be food production, it could be logistics, it could be assembling. And honestly, it's every part of UK GDP and services will be going through warehouses to some degree.
Yeah, I assume that so much people have to not only move stuff, but they also have to produce stuff as well.
Absolutely.
And they need that space to be able to do it in the most cost-efficient way.
Correct.
So to start off with this subject of urban logistics, I want to start right off with the basics of what's changing in the markets and why should real asset investors be paying attention to how I'm doing my shopping?
Well, let's start with industrial in general. And Tim mentioned sheds, which is probably an unhelpful, self-depreciating way.
It's very reductive.
It talks about it. As Tim mentioned, it goes much more than that. It's much more scientific than that. Mm-hmm. If during the course of this podcast we start calling them sheds, forgive us. We don't mean it, but it's just habit. Let's start at the top with industrial. Industrial as a property sector has traditionally been quite slow in terms of returns. You get a decent total return. Most of that comes from income return. Rents and yields traditionally haven't done very much compared with the office or retail sector, for instance. That has fundamentally changed in the last 5 years, and it's become much more of an exciting asset class. And for investors in our funds, industrial has been the standout performer. So I think the last 3 years, on average, returns in industrial have been about 16% per year, versus about 6% for the all property average. So it's done really well. What's driven that kind of depends on the part of industrial you're looking at. So very simply, you can divide industrial into two. You've got distribution warehouses, also known as logistics facilities. And by this, we often refer to the big regional buildings, almost said sheds then, but big regional buildings that you see.
Distribution centres, perhaps.
Yeah, when you're travelling up the motorway. And then there's multi-let industrial, which are the smaller units of space that you'll see dotted around the edge of cities, home to many and varied different occupiers. What's really driven the distribution center side of life has been e-commerce. So you've had a fundamental structural change in the way people shop, and that's supported the use of these regional centers in terms of how the role they play in getting goods from producer to consumer. Multi-lets have been driven by, there's a demand side there as well. There's reasonable growth in the small and medium-sized company space.
Could you break that down for me? So we used to have this kind of setup where I would order something online and a regional distribution center, as you put it, would put it onto a van or a lorry and drive it to my house, but from quite a long distance away. So it would add to the delivery time. Is that what I'm thinking of?
Yeah. And that e-commerce side of things has driven e-commerce, but it's also very much driving the smaller shed market. So as well as the small companies doing okay and being reasonably robust, e-commerce doesn't only need the big regional product. It applies to the smaller edge of town as well. And there isn't really a consistent definition of what urban logistics, which is the part of the distribution network that does that last mile, and we'll get on to what that means. There isn't really a definition of what that looks like in product terms. It's more of a description of the process, which has become more and more important the more we shop online.
Okay.
And we're seeing two things. Firstly, and this is the bit that hasn't really changed, but nevertheless is very important. Business to business delivery, still urban logistics, is about 50% of all what we call the last mile. Still very important. The bit that's really grown is the consumer facing the e-commerce stuff. That it's Amazon and their competitors delivering stuff to our houses.
Okay,
that's arguably the more exciting bit, but not the be all and end all of urban logistics.
Interesting. And so, Tim, what this shift in behaviour has meant what for these kind of smaller properties? Where have you seen the market change in the demand side from property investors?
Well, one of the key points, we talked about the change in logistics. If you are, for example, buying or picking up some products from a shop, you're in effect doing the last mile delivery.
Yeah,
you're going to the shop to pick and pack
completely.
And take it home. So, as part of that shift, there is a whole new supply that has been created to deliver products to our doors. And that will mean that on a traditional model, to get to basically a store, a product might go through 2 to 3 warehouses. To be delivered to our house, it might end up going through 4 to 5 warehouses and gradually smaller warehouses. So again, when we're talking the last mile, that is the most challenging element of logistics in terms of cost for operators.
Why is that? Why is last mile, that distance from the final warehouse to my house, the most difficult for operators?
Because of loss of efficiency. Rather than going to 1 or 10 stores within a region in one large HGV, you're breaking down into individual parcels to be delivered to 10 addresses within a 7-mile radius or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. What it does mean is a lot more opportunity. So we're seeing very small local parcel businesses who are growing substantially because they are doing that last mile on behalf of major national or international logistics chains. So there's growth and e-commerce penetration at every level of warehouse size.
I think it's also important to reflect on the supply chain in general. We're talking about e-commerce, and it's not necessarily that new.
Yeah.
It's something we've been familiar with for 10 years, but in real estate terms, it's still quite embryonic in the sense that there are a lot of supply chains that aren't fully rationalized to account for the way e-commerce works. And in general, and this applies to the whole supply chain, not just the last mile or urban logistics, e-commerce requires more physical space because these companies need to have a greater variety of product closer to their end market. And something that is really challenging for many of the companies operating this space is returns. So people buying stuff online, 4 pairs of trousers and sending 3 back or whatever it might be. And that in itself requires more physical space and operational intensity to handle.
I imagine you've got to, not as your operator, you need to be able to not only send out these 4 pairs of jeans, but you need to be able to have a system in place to accept the return of those 3 pairs of jeans that the client didn't want and assess them for viability. Like, can these be resold, I would imagine, is a real kind of consideration for these clothing e-commerce operators, would you say?
Yeah,
absolutely.
So if I've understood this urban logistics right, it's about kind of a lot of these industrial spaces coming closer to town centres where the consumers, whether those are businesses or people individually, are are living, and that's driving up rent, I would imagine. Talk to us a little bit about the supply of these kind of properties that are suitable enough for worthy investment of in the industrial space.
We're seeing more demand for buildings of between, say, 30 and 100,000 square foot for urban logistics on near urban centres. And for the last 20 years, really, these buildings have been out of favour from well, basically, they haven't been developed.
And why is that? What's prevented these companies from developing these spaces to be appropriate to the needs of today?
A fundamental part is down to build cost. If you have the choice of putting one large warehouse on a unit or a number of smaller buildings, it may cost up to 40% less. So in terms of viability as a developer, as an owner, it is more profitable to build less larger units than a number of smaller units. But there's also been a change with more e-commerce. We are looking at a change in the nature of building, what is actually required.
Okay.
Because we're talking about having HGVs bringing goods in from regional centres.
So these big lorries that can pack a huge amount of goods in that
Absolutely.
Sense.
And then the goods actually being broken down into vans, into light goods vehicles. So for the larger units, we are seeing more demand for units which have dot levelers and level loading doors, whereas historically a lot of the smaller units would tend to have just level loading doors.
So that would be kind of being able to take, to understand this correctly, that say like a pile of parcels kind of at the same level as the van, but now you need to accept them at the same level as the lorry and then take them three or 4 feet lower onto the van and work out how you pack that van, I imagine, is such a key point of efficiency for these logistics operators.
Absolutely, yes.
So this is really kind of changing not only the nature, the demand for this kind of the literal floor space of these properties, but also the way these properties are developed. How are you seeing it as a owner of these properties? What changes in developments are you seeing being put into the place in the market?
But there's still a significant undersupply of urban logistics units.
Mm-hmm.
There really aren't that many schemes coming forward. One of the positives where the schemes are being built is the units don't just appeal to urban logistics suppliers. I mean, our fund is currently on site constructing a scheme on the outskirts of Birmingham. And whilst we do have parcel businesses looking at it, we also have two manufacturers, and also more of a general business services.
I mean, that brings us back to that whole variety of these businesses using industrial space.
There's an underpin, and when it comes down to it, there shouldn't be a differential in rent between any of these operators. So from a landlord's point of view, there's still that variety and underpin, which is good news.
To take that back, to press you a little bit on that investment point, how has this space... You mentioned some incredible growth numbers in investment returns. Can you break that down into a bit of what does that mean in true sterling terms, in terms of rent for industrial spaces?
For industrial spaces, I mean, certainly there are throughout Greater London, there are in the main locations, rather, so Park Royal, Heathrow, you've probably seen about 65% rental growth on standard industrial. Now, that varies from very small units to mid-box, mid-size logistics units. But there are also pockets of London which have seen 200% rental growth for smaller units over that time. It's not just London. Pretty much every major town and city has seen significant rental growth. Up to 20-30%.
Wow.
You know, in regional locations.
And as we were saying at the start, this is very rare for the industrial market to see such levels of rental growth. And part of that's the demand equation.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of that's the supply equation, which we've already talked about, especially in the small end of the market for multi-lets. You just don't build the stock anymore. And the tension on rents is significant. But also importantly, public policy is responding to this. So there's a recognition in London and elsewhere that we're losing too much industrial space. So it's recognised by the London Plan. They are seeking measures to preserve employment space, and industrial is part of that. So in certain areas, you will not be able to have a net loss of industrial space.
Interesting. So where perhaps we might have seen a lot of these calls to develop residential property on what would be called brownfield sites, like formerly industrial spaces, now we need to maintain that balance a little bit more, at least in London here, to say that there still needs to be those spaces devoted to industrial because of the variety of industries, businesses that could be using them and help drive the economy, but not to go overboard and kill our congestion, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. And that gets us back onto the product type. So there's a push for more multi-storey warehousing and logistics facilities or mixed-use industrial residential accommodation in London.
So that multi-storey point, tell me, how would that work? I struggle to imagine a multi-storey warehouse except for being this a huge, back to the word shed, huge shed on multiple levels. What does this look like?
I mean, there are different types. There's multi-storey and then there's multi-level. Okay. Multi-storey will generally have ramps. Picture a car park, but very large ramps.
A very large ramp.
And there was one scheme built in Heathrow called X2, which had a slightly checkered past due to the specification. Mm-hmm. Throughout the world, when there's very constrained land supply, so predominantly in Asia, then you are seeing a multi-storey building, certainly in Singapore, 8 stories high, with huge ramps. Now, it's a very different market with structural support from the government. But within London at the moment, there are 27 schemes that are being investigated for either multi-storey, multi-level, intensification or mixed use. Some are genuinely there to be delivered. It's early days. Mm-hmm. But there is one scheme in Park Royal called The Generator, which obtained detailed planning consent within the last month or so. There's another scheme in Silvertown, which Gaisley have recently applied for planning consent. Now, they're two very different extremes. The Generator is approximately 140,000 square foot, split over 4 levels. That could be let to 3 or 4 different tenants, different one occupier per level, or it could be 30 different operators. And there are examples in Munich where you have food production next to glaziers, next to, you know, designers. There's all sorts. Yeah. And there's a bit of a community that can be built up and people working together and trading off each other. So it's a very new sector. If you think about the Gaisley scheme in Silvertown, that is pure logistics. Mm. So that's 2 or 3 stories. And that will literally be a logistics unit. So very different models.
Interesting. It feels like that these developments of multi-storey are really about doing more with less, of like doing as much as possible with a limited kind of ground space that exists.
Yeah, I think it's early days, and certainly for what I believe we'll see is this Park Royal scheme is delivered by planning policy from the GLA. Mm-hmm. That's St George, part of Buckingham.
That's the Greater London Authority, right? We're still talking about London here.
Absolutely. So that scheme, in order to get resident consent for about 2,900 residential units, St George have to retain the industrial use. So they're squeezing it onto a smaller land base. That's in a prime industrial location, so you could see it, you know, it should work. So you have residential developers who, in order to deliver their residential, because of policy support now for industrial, because too much has gone, have to build up. Then you have well-funded global logistics operators who are undoubtedly moving into town. Mm-hmm. So Prologis and Gaisley are two prime examples.
Two big names in that space.
In the global logistics market, absolutely. Who historically haven't been owners of city centre or very urban schemes. You also have some local authorities who are looking at it on their own sites. There is, you know, a real appreciation that too much industrial land or industrial space has been lost too quickly.
So it seems to me that this growth of these kind of big players are really getting into this urban logistics space, and it's really driving returns for the industrial sector. It all seems a little bit too good to be true for investors, wouldn't you say? Like, I'm sure investors shouldn't start allocating whole swathes of their commercial property exposure to industrial property, in particular the urban logistics model. What are the risks? Bill, you mentioned the word externalities earlier. Mm-hmm. What are the counterpoints to this as an investment? What should investors be really looking out for?
Well, firstly, the risks to investors can emanate from the occupier side, mm-hmm. side of life. So as you surmise, Mark, that there is a strong growth story here, and that will continue. So urban logistics in general is still somewhere where we would like to invest and where we see a good future. More specifically, there will be more challenges occupiers face. So we talked about externalities and congestion and pollution being key things that policymakers are looking at. And the two reactions to that, there's the introduction of low emission zones. So again, keep using London as an example, the ultra-low emission zone came into force in April, I think it was, this year, so relatively recently. For a lorry entering London, it'll have to pay about £100 a day. TfL allegedly are receiving over £200,000 a day in revenue from this.
Great revenue for local authorities. Like, you could see many other local authorities looking at that and going, that is a green, a lucrative, public policy introduction that I could easily put into place here in Manchester, Birmingham, wherever it could be.
There are 18 towns and cities who are reportedly at various stages of either appraising it or close to introducing it.
And I imagine that's something definitely that occupiers and developers need to be looking at.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's coming to a city near you soon, wherever that might be. It just makes sense. It's an easy revenue-raising exercise, but it's working in terms of reducing pollution and congestion. So that's something occupiers have to deal with. And that's almost a micro-location consideration. So what side of the boundary do you want to be on as an occupier? If you're within the boundary, then you pay the charge anyway, so it doesn't really matter. But if your clients are sending you goods from outside, they will have to then incur a cost, which will probably be passed onto you and then onto your consumers. So maybe it's better to be on the edge of the boundary, so that part of the process where the goods are coming to your logistics facility doesn't incur the charge, but then you're going to pay it anyway to go into an urban area. Problem is that zone will move. So in the case of London, it's currently out to around the North and South Circular. It's more narrow than that, but it will move out to the North and South Circular and probably M25 before too long. So it's almost like a moving target.
Which is quite difficult for property investors when they're looking at these kind of ventures for 10, 20 years. If you have to start thinking in the back of your mind, we're outside the low emission zone now, so our setup works. But what does public policy look like for the next 5 years, next 10 years?
Yeah, exactly. Certainty is—it's a cliche, but you need certainty to make these decisions, and support the principle of the low emission zones, of course. But we kind of would prefer them to stick to the current boundary, and then you can act around it. And what that policy has also done is encourage greater use of electric vehicles. And again, for the greater good, and certainly no criticism of that, but it's creating challenges for occupiers in terms of upgrading their fleet. These things cost money. A anecdote which might not sound so important, but I think it emphasises why these things are challenges. If you electric vehicle weighs more than a traditional vehicle, so many drivers need a HGV license to operate them, and that costs more money. They command more wages. Yeah. They're less widely available, and that's creating extra challenges for occupiers.
And if anything, like that, the major part of that last mile cost is the driver, him or herself, and so that would drive that up. I'm also thinking about bridges with weight limits as well. If you suddenly have these very heavy, much heavier vehicles, you have to plan your routes very differently, I would also imagine.
Yes, yeah, and Tim lives near to Hammersmith Bridge, which is out of action for about 3 years. I'm not saying that was due to urban logistics, but there are implications to this. But also, policy towards electric vehicles is great, but the supply of electric vehicles
and
batteries is a conversation for another day, but it's not that easy.
And also the capacity of our power networks.
Oh, exactly. So the entire infrastructure of the UK, is it set up to supply enough power to not only these industrial centres, which I would imagine if they're moving towards a more urban model, already puts more pressure on, if you're already dealing with urban housing, which are many more households in a smaller space, to adding in more industrial into that mix, the huge amount of power, not only for the electric vehicles, but also the building itself, is going to create an immense higher cost for both the governments and for individual occupiers. Yep.
Yeah. But I think, in essence, these are surmountable problems, and and where it leaves us as investors is still enthusiastic about the sector. We would tread carefully on the path in terms of picking the right micro-location. By that, I mean, you know, relationship to emission charging areas. Macro location, so we've talked about a lot about London, but the rest of the UK city centres are growing. They're becoming more dense in terms of population and businesses. And again, 50% of this is business to business travel, so that business density is important. We can track expectations for population growth and expectations for consumer spending and start to pick out areas which, in theory, should work well for this product. And where we are also a little more cautious is on proximity. So not suggesting the likes of Gazy and Prologis and people who have been buying heavily in this sector are wrong, far from it. But medium to long term, I think I can see a scenario where the importance of proximity lessens slightly. A couple of things driving that. The range of electric vehicles will get better as technology improves. The software technology in terms of the routing of deliveries and AI and all the rest of it, that can only
becomes more efficient.
It can only become more efficient. And perhaps a softer thing, but no less important, is consumer behaviour. So we've talked a lot about the need for speed and I want my good same day, same hour, whatever. But I'm not sure the consumer in general is aware of those externalities that are associated with those choices. So if you want your electric toothbrush from Amazon, you click same day, please. Do you really consider that actually you might be forcing the delivery network to make one trip just for your house? Whereas if you could wait 4 or 5 days, they can batch it up and be much more efficient.
You could easily see these e-commerce operators say at the point of checkout giving you a little saying, you can offer would you like same or next day delivery, but this will incur this amount of carbon, X additional carbon, and you can play it to the sustainability angle. Or you could even, I imagine, you could do a cost angle of, would you like a 5% discount for waiting 3 or 4 days for your pair of socks? How much do you need a pair of socks at the same day?
Yeah, exactly. I can really see that take off. And it might not just be the extra premium price, but like you say, it could be a discount, or it could be that more environmental angle where it might make the consumer think, you know what, I don't need this tomorrow.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to have tomorrow, but I hadn't considered what the costs are. And again, the good thing for us as investors is this is helping to inform public policy. And so not just around pollution charging and congestion charging, but consolidation centres are likely to become a more important product.
What's a consolidation centre when it's at home?
The good question. It is basically a logistics facility where multiple operators can process their goods and send it out in one lorry load rather than several.
So this would be lots of different shops kind of banding together saying, we're all going to use a single provider to deliver our goods.
Exactly, and it works well in Regent Street, for instance.
So, Regent Street here in London?
Yeah, so the retailers in Regent Street are served by one electric vehicle delivering their product to the stores instead of, I don't know how many shops there are on Regent Street, but previously 50 or whatever it might be.
So rather all than all of these vehicles, like each individual vehicle coming down to every single shop, you now just have this one electric one, which is...
Exactly. And it saves costs for the retailers. It saves congestion, less congestion charging, so lower costs for the operators as well.
And you mentioned a public policy angle. So local authorities are getting involved in this?
It's certainly supported by public policy. Another example is construction material consolidation centres. So if you're building a building, that relies on kind of just-in-time delivery of bricks, cement, marble facades, whatever it might be.
You don't want the bricks too early, and don't want them too late.
Exactly. So it's a bit like car manufacturing in that regard. So what works there is having the materials stored off-site, so somewhere in East London, brought into site, into central London, in a coordinated way, keeps the lorry loads down. Obviously, there's safety issues around the amount of construction lorries we have on our roads, which can be alleviated by this, and it also reduces costs and uncertainty for developers. Mm. And we're also seeing for new buildings, so either a new district or a brand new major office building, say, in the planning requirement, they'll stipulate the use of a consolidation centre. So instead of everyone working in an office building receiving their Amazon package separately throughout the day, which not only creates challenges for the front of house, but it creates challenges for the road network, they will say, OK, you can only use a consolidation centre and bring in one lorry load or van load a day to keep that traffic.
It's kind of like the Daily Post comes at 12 and 3 in that sort of sense.
Yeah, so you're building up, you know, one Smith Street or whatever it might be, will actually have an address somewhere else in an industrial park where all the goods go to, and then they sort out how and when and how often that gets delivered to the building.
Interesting. And Tim, on the consolidation centres point, how is a fund like yours kind of looking at these new developments in the logistics space, and how are they being incorporated into a portfolio, say?
At the moment, they are rare. You know, I'm probably only aware of half a dozen of them. I'm sure there may be more. So it's not generally an institutional buy, although certainly AXA, you know, Bill was talking about an office building in the City of London. They have to, in order to build that office building, create a consolidation centre, as Bill has said. So they will be owning that function. I think, to be honest with you, it's a similar building.
Yep.
It depends on the income strip. It depends on who's operating it. So that really will impact the investment pricing and criteria.
Yeah, I think the good news is it's supported by public policy. So there will be a local authority or central authority like the GLA or devolved authority outside of London where they will want to support this. Whether it's making a more attractive deal in terms of identifying land where these could built on partnering with a developer or an institution to make it happen.
Interesting.
We see a good future with these.
Interesting. So to begin to bring this conversation to a close, gentlemen, I'd like to focus a little bit more on the performance point for pension investors going forward. It seems to me that it's very much a bright future for the e-commerce sector and therefore urban logistics, but it's an execution as an investment strategy that has to be quite targeted and quite thoughtful. So, Tim, can you just elaborate how you're approaching it for an outlook going forward?
And certainly is. I mean, I work on a specialist industrial fund. Mm. We have a very consistent approach of sticking to key fundamentals, whether that's, and it's supply demand in any location. And that can be a supply of industrial land or allocated land coming forward, which will potentially loosen the demand-supply balance that is currently favouring landlords and lead to a lower level of rental growth or just more competition for occupiers.
Mm.
So, again, supply and demand is absolutely key. We're looking at towns and cities with significant infrastructure projects, growth projects. Again, using some of Bill's earlier research into growing locations, towns, cities throughout the UK.
So what you're saying there is the investors haven't necessarily missed the boat, Bill.
Far from it. We can track outperformance for urban logistics relative to general industrial over the historic past, but we expect that outperformance to persist. We talked about the upsides. So, you know, there's the clear trajectory on how people are shopping, the public policy response to encourage more urban logistics and consolidation centres, which is part of the story. We've talked about the challenges that occupiers face in terms of pollution charging, electrification of their vehicles and so on. And those challenges become investor challenges, if you like, because we need to understand those and provide the right product in the right locations. But the upsides more than outweigh the downsides. But what we would say is just it's not quite as simple as get the most centrally located site you possibly can.
Because of the risk of overpaying for that proximity.
Yeah, I think there is a risk of overpaying. As technology improves, there's always obsolescence risks. But as I said, the prospects of urban logistics and the requirements around it are sufficient to outweigh those risks. We would say the most compelling support comes from that policy response and the concerns around congestion and pollution and how real estate can provide a solution to that. Perhaps more so than the consumer, but the consumer is, of course, a very, very strong driver on this.
A very strong driver. My final question is, why should urban logistics and the industrial sector continue to have a place in investors commercial property exposure?
First thing to say to that, Mark, is that although we've talked passionately about industrial product for the last 25 minutes, we also should remember that this isn't our money. We're looking after it on behalf of pension holders across the nation. So gaining a relative advantage over the benchmark is always a key strategy. So with urban logistics, we're looking at getting an extra 1% a year in returns versus a traditional industrial holding. That outperformance is still very much to play for. And we see some clear opportunity in terms of consumer preference, demography, and perhaps most compellingly, that urban policy recommendation to be more efficient in the way goods are being delivered, whether that's to the consumer or to businesses.
Mm-hmm. And Tim, from a fund management perspective, what do you see as the real drivers of this going forward?
One of the key things, and we have touched on it, is the growth in delivery addresses in new homes. And there is a correlation between new house building throughout the UK and requirement for new warehouse space. And this will continue to lead to a growth and also an opportunity for rental growth throughout the sector. Currently, we're not seeing an end to rental growth within the multi-let industrial sector and urban logistics sector. And that, again, is down to that supply-demand imbalance.
Perfect. Well, I think that's a really interesting note to end this fascinating discussion on. Thank you both so much for being here. Thank you so much, Bill.
Thanks, Mark.
See you again on the podcast very soon for your fourth outing, I'm sure.
I'm sure I'll be back.
And Tim, thank you so much for your first time on the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And if you'd like to read more about the team's fascinating research, be sure to visit our website, Elgium Real Assets, and be sure to listen again next week for more Elgium Talks. Thank you and goodbye. If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.